All right, good morning. We'll go ahead and get started. Some brief introductions. My name is Manny Markakis. I'm the Clinical Pharmacy Program Manager and Residency Director for the Pharmacy here at Boca Raton Regional Hospital. And I have the honor and privilege of introducing today's speaker. Dr. Anderson Mabor will be speaking about proton pump inhibitors today for us all. He received his Doctor of Pharmacy from the University of Florida. And most of you, or some of you may not know, he was actually one of our inaugural residents here at Boca Raton Regional Hospital. And he has accepted a position with us, and he's been with us for a good 4 or 5 years at this point. He currently serves as faculty for the residency program. He is one of our internal he's our only internal medicine clinical pharmacist. You might see him on your teams. He is board certified in pharmacotherapy, and he'll be talking to us today about an important topic that some of you may or may not realize. So without further ado, Anderson Mabor.
Thank you so much, Manny, for that introduction, and a special thanks for volunteering me for this presentation. Okay. Thanks. So before we start, I'd like to say that I have no actual potential conflicts of interest in relation to this presentation. I don't own any stock. I don't serve on any pharmaceutical boards. If I did, I promise you I wouldn't be here today. I'll be on a boat somewhere. So our objectives for this presentation, by the end of this presentation, we're hoping that we'll be able to evaluate the potential risk associated with proton pump inhibitors. We'll be able to describe appropriate use of proton pump inhibitors in hospitalized patients, as well as determine when to discontinue proton pump inhibitors. Before we start, it's important to get a good idea exactly what is a proton pump inhibitor. So this is a diagram of a parietal cell, which is a cell that's responsible for secreting hydrochloric acid into the gastric lumen and responsible for causing a low pH to aid in mechanical digestion. As the name implies, proton pump inhibitors literally block the hydrogen-potassium ATPase proton pump. And the way the parietal cells secrete hydrochloric acid is they get a variety of different stimulators which act at the histamine receptor, acetylcholine, gastrin, and a handful of other receptors. And by different pathways, they end up inducing the release of hydrogen ions into the gastric lumen. So when you block the proton pumps, it has the most profound effect on increasing your gastric pH, because as opposed to blocking the histamine receptors, where you can have the potential for having other pathways to potentially release hydrogen ions, when you block the PPI with the PPIs, you get the most profound. So they're the most effective agents at increasing gastric pH. So when you do block the proton pump with the PPIs, it's actually a irreversible inhibition, similar to the Plavix or aspirin with platelets. The drugs themselves have a half-life of only about 2 to 3 hours, but when they initially bind to the pumps, they block about 70% of the pumps. So therefore, compared to histamine H2 blockers, they are not as effective within the first hour or within the first day. But when they do get to their max efficacy at about 3 days or so, they work better than any other agent. The other thing to note with these agents is once they work, because they're irreversible, the only way they're going to stop working is once your body creates a new proton pump in those parietal cells. So they do last for about 3 days after you take the drug. So the first PPI was discovered in 1975, and 4 years later, omeprazole was derived from that compound. The year after, in 1980, IND was applied for, and 10 years later, in 1990, the first PPI was approved. And the world was never the same since. Literally everybody is on a PPI these days. So we now have 6 agents that we have in a PPI class. There's more than 6 products because they come in different formulations, but we have 6 agents. An important thing to know with these six agents is no one agent is any more efficacious than the other as long as you use them in equivalent doses. But they do have different formulations. Some of them you can give to patients with gastric and intestinal tubes. Some of them you can give IV, such as Protonix or esomeprazole. But they are all considered to be equally as effective. You can use PPIs for pretty much anything that you need to increase your gastric pH for. The most popular use is probably gastroesophageal reflux disease. The typical recommended treatment is 4 to 8 weeks, depending on which product you're using, but most people would probably treat for 8 weeks. And this is significantly a shorter period of time than you would need to treat with H2 blockers. You can also use these agents for complications of GERD, such as erosive esophagitis or Barrett's esophagus, where you'll be treating for a longer period of time or potentially indefinitely. We use these PPIs for stress ulcer prophylaxis. We use them to treat and heal gastric ulcers, duodenal ulcers, and we also use them to prevent and heal NSAID-induced ulcers as well. We use these agents for H. pylori eradication as part of either triple or quadruple therapy for 10 to 14 days, as well as hypersecretory conditions as well. So these agents are one of the few classes that are also available over the counter. So in 2000, the FDA decided that omeprazole was safe and effective enough to allow it to be put over the counter so patients could directly purchase these agents without talking to a pharmacist, physician, or any other healthcare professional. The indication that they list on the package labeling is heartburn, and they restrict the use of these agents for a 14-day course, and they do say clearly in there, limit one course within 4 months. So essentially a patient can do up to 3 courses in a year. And if you're wondering why would any drug company want to put their drug over the counter, it's all about the money. So they essentially, once the period of exclusivity is running out, these drugs will try to push the same as you saw with Flonase and Nasonex. They'll try to push their drugs on the market as long as they're considered safe so they can still get a decent portion of the market share as opposed to the generic companies getting all the market share. So we did talk about the 14-day maximum limit, but if you go to the to any pharmacy right now and you look at any of these formulations, including the generics, you're going to see that every last one of them comes in a 42-pack. So if your patients are anything like my dad, they absolutely will not read instructions. So they're going to literally take all 42 tablets and then they'll go back to the pharmacy and get another pack and continue until somebody tells them to stop. So while these drugs are really intended for short-term use, we do have a lot of patients that continue these agents and they'll come into the hospital and you take a look at their med rec and you literally have no idea why they're on a PPI. We're pretty familiar with some of the short-term adverse effects of these agents. Headache, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, flatulence are pretty common. And literally, if a patient asks you what are the potential side effects of a drug and you have no idea, if you say headache, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, flatulence, there's a 95% chance you'll probably be right. So therefore, these drugs are pretty inert. They're very well tolerated by the patients, especially compared to the previous drugs that were available, such as the H2 blockers, the anti-muscarinic agents, and the cytoprotective agents as well. What we're not as familiar with is some of the long-term effects of these drugs. And these drugs have been around now for 27 years. They've been on the market. And it seems like every 6 months to 12 months or so, we get a headline like this that says these heartburn drugs are linked to higher risk of death. And literally within a couple of days, you get a multitude of these and it's all over the news. And next thing you know, your patient's coming in asking you, am I gonna die from taking my PPI? So we really need to be able to sort through the information and see, is it better for a patient to be on a PPI, or should they use alternate drugs or not take them at all? So these are this is a list of a lot of the different potential associations with the PPI. And we've seen an increase in these primarily because there's a lot more data available. These drugs have been approved for the past 27 years, as well there's the insurance, larger insurance companies and national databases collect a lot of information that they can easily aggregate and publish. So we see a lot of these coming from insurance companies or national health services. And what we'll notice is, I know it's difficult to read, but with all of these, not all of them, the majority of them, the reason why they're potentially an adverse effect of a PPI is due to the increase in the gastric pH. So some of these same things could potentially happen with other agents that increase your gastric pH, but the increase is not as profound, so therefore the risk may not be significant. So we're going to cover five of the common ones that we get questions about all the time, which includes dementia, pneumonia, CKD, C. diff infection, as well as bone fractures. So we're going to start with dementia. So the proposed mechanism for dementia is that there, because of the increase in the gastric pH, there's a reduction in B12 absorption, which affects the neurological function, as well as a potential development of amyloid plaques as seen in Alzheimer's patients. And the reason we're a little bit concerned about dementia is because in 2015, the largest German insurer conducted a cohort study using inpatient and outpatient data in elderly patients older than 75. And what they found was that the PPIs were associated with an increased risk of dementia with a hazard ratio of 1.44, which was significant. However, we do consider to need further evaluation, because if we look at the baseline information of these patients, we'll see that only 4% of their patients were using PPIs compared to over here, which we use them way more commonly than apparently in Germany. And aside from that, there was a significant higher depression rate, stroke rate, as well as ischemic heart disease and polypharmacy as well. So in the group that were receiving the PPIs. So we can't really put a clear-cut association between these two right now. Next up, we have pneumonia. And the proposed mechanism for pneumonia is the increase in gastric pH allows for bacterial growth in the upper GI and putting the patients at risk, especially for gram-negative infections. And with the pneumonia, what we find is that there seems to be an association with hospital-acquired pneumonia, but not as much so with community-acquired pneumonia. With hospital-acquired pneumonia, as you would assume, patients who are ventilated are at the greatest risk. But when we look at patients that are hospitalized but not in the ICU, we see that for every 111 patients we treat with a PPI, the odds that one of them is going to develop nosocomial pneumonia from it. When we look at the community-acquired pneumonia, one case control suggested that for every 226 patients we treat with a PPI, that we could potentially cause one community-acquired pneumonia, but two stronger studies, one meta-analysis and a pooled analysis of some previous studies showed no increased risk in community-acquired pneumonia for these patients. The next up is chronic kidney disease, and the potential mechanism is PPIs have been linked to acute kidney injury as well as hypomagnesemia as well, which the FDA has put out an advisory about the hypomagnesemia, saying that you may need to supplement these patients and to potentially monitor these patients who are on PPIs. So the mechanism is if the patients are getting recurrent AKIs along with the hypomagnesemia, then they're at risk for declining renal function over time. And what we looked at is, for this one, is the ERIC study, which was in 2016, which was a prospective cohort going back to 1999. And they're only looking at patients between the age of 45 to 64. And they decided to take a look at the subset of these patients with a GFR greater than 60. And what they found is that the PPI was associated with an increased risk of CKD with a hazard ratio of 1.45. The H2 blockers, patients who are on H2 blockers in that particular study was not associated with an increased risk of CKD. It was a pretty well-designed study, but then again, we still need further information, like pretty much any of these. And the issue we have is nobody is going to sponsor a randomized controlled trial to say, yes, don't use my drug because it's going to kill you. So therefore, we rely on a lot on these observational data and FDA advisories to determine how we proceed from there. So next up, we have our C. diff infections. And the proposed mechanism, again, is potential in, because of the increase in the gastric pH, it would allow for C. difficile overgrowth. And what we looked at was we had a meta-analysis who suggested an association with an odds ratio of 1.74. And this was even stronger in patients who are taking antibiotics along with their PPIs. That proposed mechanism being that if you're wiping out the good bacteria and you're also allowing C. diff not to get destroyed in your food and while you're eating, then you can have, then you're at even higher risk. And that odds ratio was 1.96. And they also showed that the H2 receptor blockers themselves have a potential for an increased risk for C. diff, but it is lower than the risk with the PPIs. So you probably could hypothesize that if you have to put a patient on an H2 blocker who's at risk for C. diff or who's on antibiotics, maybe you potentially would prefer to use H2 blocker or PPI if you don't have to use a PPI. There was also a 42% increased risk in recurrence of C. diff infections within the first 90 days for patients that were on PPIs. And if we look at inpatients generally, we needed to treat 553 patients with daily PPIs in order to develop one C. diff infection. So the FDA did publish advisory and a safety communication. And their recommendation is that we use these drugs with the lowest dose possible for the shortest duration possible. And like many of these potential long-term side effects, they're directly related to how long you've been on these drugs as well as what dose of the drug you're taking. Next up is a bone fracture. So we probably have the most data available for bone fractures. Bone fractures with the potential mechanism being that there is an interference with the calcium absorption due to the increased GI pH. And it's hypothesized that postmenopausal women specifically are at risk, increased risk for hip fractures, spine fractures, as well as wrist fractures while they're on these drugs. The FDA decided to take a look at this back in 2010, and they used 7 epidemiological studies. And what they found was that there was an increased risk, but only for patients that had previous other risk factors for bone fractures. And again, it was, like we talked about before, it was associated with using PPIs in higher doses, as well as using PPIs for a length of time greater than a year. We don't have the Canadian Gastroenterological Association in their guidelines published that you'd have to treat 2,000 Canadian women in order with a PPI in order to get one incidence of a bone fracture. So therefore, the FDA did put out an advisory, but decided against adding any warnings for bone fractures to their labeling. The American Gastroenterological Association, their recommendations as of now with their last update on this is that no routine bone mineral density screening be done for these patients, although there was a recent study that showed that there is a potential for increased risk of osteoporosis and osteopenia in 2016. And if your patients are not hypocalcemic, not to give them any more not to increase their dietary intake of calcium above the recommended dietary allowance. So next up, we'll talk a little bit about inpatient stress ulcer prophylaxis, which always seems to be a question of do we not, and at the end we just say, okay, everybody gets PPIs. So there's a lot of guidelines mention stress ulcer prophylaxis, but there's not a clear consensus as to who do we prophylax or and who we don't prophylax. The Surviving Sepsis 2016 campaign, their recommendation is not that everybody with sepsis get a PPI. It's if you have sepsis and you have other risk factors for a GI bleed, then you should be on PPI, but not just for having sepsis alone. We have the EASE guidelines from 2008. They're a little bit more vague and with not as many details. The most detailed guideline we have available is the ASHP guidelines, but they're last published in 1999. And we know we have a lot of information that's come out since 1999. And every year since 2014, they've been threatening to publish the updated guidelines, but we're still waiting and see what their recommendations are. So instead of going through each one individually, what we're going to do is take a look and see where all the guidelines agree, and so we can at least agree on who should absolutely get stress ulcer prophylaxis. So patients that we consider to need stress ulcer prophylaxis include patients who are on mechanical ventilation. So the EASE guidelines does not specify, but the ASHP guidelines recommend for patients who are on a ventilator for greater than 48 hours. Patients with coagulopathy, the ASHP guidelines define coagulopathy as patients who have platelets less than 50,000, an INR greater than 1.5, not just because they're on Coumadin, but because their liver's not working, as well as if their APTT is greater than 2 times the normal limit. We don't have a ton of these patients here, but patients that have traumatic brain injury or major burn injuries greater than 35% would also automatically qualify for stress ulcer prophylaxis. If you look at the ASHP guidelines, they say the patient would have to be in the ICU, whereas the EASE guidelines say any of these patients should be on stress ulcer prophylaxis. Next up, we have a list of patients who, if they have more than one of these risk factors, so two or more, they probably should be on stress ulcer prophylaxis. So if a patient has an extended ICU stay greater than 7 days, and they have sepsis, and or sepsis, and or multiple trauma, or a history of a GI bleed within the past year, or high-dose corticosteroids, meaning 250 milligrams of hydrocortisone equivalent, then they probably should be on stress ulcer prophylaxis as well. And you see other risk factors as well, and it's dependent up to you as to whether or not you think these patients need it. But the moral of the story is that most patients will be just fine without stress ulcer prophylaxis if they don't meet these criteria. So you ask, exactly how much is 250 milligrams of hydrocortisone equivalent to? Say my patient is in the neuro ICU and they're on dexamethasone. How much is that? So 250 milligrams of hydrocortisone is 62.5 milligrams of prednisone or prednisolone, and it's equivalent to 50 milligrams of methylprednisolone, and that's equivalent to about 10 milligrams of dexamethasone. So another other things that the current guidelines agree on is that so far, even though we have data to suggest that some of these long-term effects may be more associated with PPIs because the increase in gastric pH is more profound, they cannot make a recommendation that any agent, whether it be PPIs, H2 blockers, or sucralfate, is superior to the other for stress ulcer prophylaxis. Maybe that will change with future guideline updates, but as of now, they're all considered to be equivalent. There's been some talk as to using H2 blockers as opposed to PPIs for most patients, but they're also well tolerated, but they have side effects of their own. The other thing the guidelines agree on is that when the patient no longer have risk for stress ulcer prophylaxis, they should be discontinued. If not, then at a minimum, before the patients get discharged, they should be discontinued. And what we see is that 50% of patients who are on PPIs while they are in the hospital end up continuing on PPIs after they're discharged from the hospital. So I have a question for you. What percentage of patients do you think were on either oral or IV pantoprazole in this hospital yesterday? So options are, 11%, 29%, 44%, or 74%? So it's a good guess. On any day, that would probably be right, but yesterday was actually 44%. And that's just Protonix, and that was not including patients who are on H2 blockers. And nationally, the rate of patients on PPIs in a hospital is anywhere from 40 to 70%, and yesterday we did fall in that category. And like we said, the half of those patients would potentially end up going on a PPI. So it's really important for us to determine how do we manage these patients and to reevaluate the need for the PPI for these patients. And in order to be able to do so, the first thing we need to know is why are they on a PPI? So if they're on a PPI and they qualify for a long-term indication, which we'll talk a little bit about what that means, then you should absolutely continue the PPI. If the patient's well managed, you can potentially try it. If they're on twice a day or a higher dose of a PPI, you can potentially try to either decrease it to a lower dose or make it once a day if they can tolerate it whenever possible, but those patients should absolutely continue on a PPI. If they're on a PPI for a short-term indication, such as mild GERD, and have completed 8 weeks of treatment with their PPI, then those patients we should look to deprescribe. And we're going to also talk about the definition of deprescribing when it comes to PPIs. If our patient comes in and we literally have no idea why they're on a PPI, odds are the benefits of the PPI does not outweigh the risk that they have for taking these drugs. It's probably one of these patients that started taking a PPI on an outpatient and they kept buying that 42-pack over and over again, and now they don't even remember why they started taking it in the first place. So a lot of our patients would fall in this unknown category. So if we don't suspect there's a real indication for a long-term use of PPI in these agents, the research shows that it's often better to discontinue or deprescribe these patients, and if we need to, add these agents on later again, or substitute with a H2 blocker. And lastly, if the patient's on stress ulcer prophylaxis, we make sure we discontinue it either when there's a decrease in the risk factors or before the patient is discharged. So like I promised, we're going to talk about who needs long-term PPI. So patients with refractory GERD, meaning that they're not completely responding to the PPI treatment after the 8 weeks, may potentially need extended PPI. There's all other options available as well, but these would be patients that you would not want to discontinue their PPI therapy. Patients with Barrett's esophagus or erosive esophagitis, you probably want to continue the PPI as well. Any patient with a hypersecretory condition, you want to continue the PPI, as well as patients who are at high risk for NSAID-induced ulcers. This does not mean everybody who is on an NSAID should get a PPI, but patients that have high risk for ulcer, plus they have other risk factors such as they're older, which is everybody in this hospital, or they're also on a steroid, then they should continue the PPI for NSAID-induced ulcer prophylaxis. So when we talk about deprescribing in terms of PPI, what we mean by that is we can take several approaches. Deprescribing can mean that we discontinue the medication altogether. deprescribing could mean that we taper the PPI off if they're on a higher dose of twice a day. And you ask, why would you want to taper the drug as opposed to just discontinue it? With the longer the patients take these drugs and the higher the dose that they're on, the patients are at a, some patients, not all patients, some patients are at a risk for rebound hypersecretion. So if you take these drugs off, these patients would have symptoms within the first 2 to 3 months. So therefore, those patients tend to tolerate the prescribing better if you taper it or if you switch them to H2 blocker as opposed to just discontinuing it altogether. And the next one is we can do is decrease the dose of the PPI. Especially with patients taking omeprazole 40, we can decrease them to 20. A lot of them can tolerate it pretty well. We can switch to an H2 receptor blocker. And we can also stop the PPI and use on demand. So when you say use on demand, we're not talking about PRN. You have heartburn and you take a Protonix or Prevacid right then and there, because we know it takes these drugs up to 3 days to get to the full effect. What we're really talking about is if the patients, some patients with either mild, with a mild GERD, if their symptoms are completely resolved after 8 weeks, you can stop it. And if they have another if they have an episode of symptoms, they start taking the PPI on the first day of symptoms, and they continue taking it daily until those symptoms resolve, and then they would stop taking it. So it's not PRN use of PPI. So we have a quick case. So we have a patient, KS, who's admitted with a suspected upper GI bleed. She was started on pantoprazole IV infusion in the ER, and she had an endoscopy done, which reveals an ulcer with a high risk for rebleeding. So what would you consider to be the best course of action for this patient? A, we would continue the pantoprazole infusion for 72 hours total. B, switch to pantoprazole 40 milligrams IV every 12 hours. Or C, we'll stop the pantoprazole infusion. Or D, send them to hospice. They're not going to make it anyway. All right. So we're going to reevaluate this a little bit. So the reason I bring this up, there was a recent meta-analysis in 2014 that took a look at this exact same question. And what they did is they compiled together 10 randomized controlled trials which looked at intermittent versus continuous PPI. And their definition of a continuous was getting an 80 milligram bolus followed by an 8 milligram per hour infusion. But their definition of intermittent was directly dependent on the trials. And we see that this is just about half of the trials, but every last one of them had a different definition of what intermittent was. Excuse me. So the first four trials, the patients literally got 40 milligrams of either omeprazole or pantoprazole daily. They did not get a bolus, and they did not get it every 12 hours. Whereas we can see down here, these patients had an 80 milligram bolus followed by 40 milligrams of pantoprazole every 6 hours. So they're pretty much getting just as much PPI as if they're getting a PPI infusion. So the route that these drugs were being taken, the dose that they're being given at, as well as the agents used, differed. So we can't make any conclusion as this is the exact regimen you should use. But we do know that popularly the option that we like to use here in this hospital is to give 40 milligrams IV every 12 hours. So if we look at the results from this study, what we see is that there is no difference between giving the intermittent versus continuous PPI, even though it was a very heterogeneous mixture of intermittent regimens. We showed no difference between those intermittent and the patients who were getting the infusions. So we could potentially save drug exposure as well as save money in these patients by not prescribing them infusion. And So all of these trials showed no difference with the exception of one. This one, which the risk ratio did not cross one, which means it was technically a little bit better. And that one was the trial where they looked at giving an 80 milligram IV bolus followed by 40 milligrams IV pantoprazole every 12 hours for 3 days. So if we go back to her case, while you can make a case for any of these, including hospice, I would consider that B is probably the best answer in this particular scenario. So in summary, what we've talked about today, we know that the long-term use of PPIs are potentially associated with many serious adverse effects. Unfortunately, we don't have good data to be able to tell us whether we need to avoid it in certain patients or not, because nobody's going to sponsor randomized controlled trials in those patients. But what we can do is avoid PPIs whenever unnecessary. That being said, if the patient has an actual indication for a PPI, they need to be on their PPI because the benefits do outweigh the risk for those patients. And then we need to, and as we talked about, 40 to 70% of patients being on a PPI at any given day in the hospital, we do need to evaluate the need for PPI in these patients prior to discharge, and knowing why they're on a PPI is a good starting point where we can proceed to deprescribing when appropriate. That being said, thank you very much for your time. Thanks again for volunteering me, Manny. You're the man. And I'll be happy to take any questions you have.
Yeah, I have two comments and a question.
So yes.
With chronic kidney disease, there's the acute allergic interstitial nephritis, which is PPIs, and the estimated incidence is 1 out of 100. But those who get that are somewhat likely to get fibrosis and get chronic kidney disease. So that's the real thing. And I've seen more patients coming in now, been on PPI for years, and they're worried about kidney injury, and that's the number I quote from the GI literature. The other thing is the osteoporosis. So the people who are at highest risk for osteoporosis, and again, it's a very low risk, again, this is from the GI literature, people who are women who are smokers who have been on twice daily PPIs for years. My question is, and this still comes up now, although I think the literature kind of settles the answer, is people who are on, say, clopidogrel, Plavix, and a PPI, and, you know, is appropriate, are they allowed to have both drugs? Is it going to decrease the bioavailability of the antiplatelet drug? And if you are going to use both, should you segregate the use? Put one in the morning, one at night? What's the latest in pharmacology literature?
Sure, very good question. So the question was about the use of PPIs and agents like clopidogrel. And the reason we're concerned about the use of those two agents together is because PPIs are substrates of the CYP2C19 enzyme, and those drugs, such as Plavix, are activated by the CYP2C19 enzyme. And a proposed mechanism is if you're inhibiting the enzyme, then you're preventing the Plavix from getting activated and potentially putting those patients at risk for coronary thrombosis. And so what we find is that the GERD guidelines definitely say that it's not a clinically significant interaction. And it doesn't, so while in vitro it appears to be significant, in vivo it doesn't appear to be as significant. And the recommendation really is if you are going to use a PPI with these agents, you want to avoid omeprazole or esomeprazole because they are the drugs that that inhibit that particular enzyme the most. So you want to use something like pantoprazole or use a H2 blocker altogether. And the other option is we do have, I have been seeing a shift with the cardiologist using more ticagrelor, which does not interact with the PPIs. And aside from Plavix, they do have other significant interactions with some of the protease inhibitors as well, where they potentially can either decrease the efficacy or cause potential higher incidence of adverse effects. So to answer your question, if you are going to give them, give it with protonics. It has the less potential side effects. The drugs, the half-life is, of Protonix is only about 2 to 3 hours, so separating it would not be a bad idea. But again, these drugs are, the half-life is relatively short, but they hang on to the proton pump inhibitor for an extended period of time, but clinically it doesn't appear to be significant. Yes, sir. Yeah, so the first question as far as the cost, I don't have that data immediately available. It depends which agent you're using, whether it's generic or whether it's brand name IV or PO. But I can say that omeprazole was on a list of top 200 drugs. Omeprazole was number 5. So we're, and Nexium was not far behind it. So we are using these drugs pretty heavily, and pantoprazole, which pretty much every hospital used, was not close to it. So we can imagine the scope in an outpatient. And your second question was if we should be using it. And there seems to be comments about a shift to, if a patient has GERD, since these agents are supposed to be the most effective, the first step that we do is to give the patients a PPI. If they don't respond to the PPI, then we look at our other options, whether we need to do surgery or whether we need to do, endoscopy or not. So pretty much almost everybody ends up on a PPI unless we say you're not responding to a PPI. And in terms of the sucralfate, it absolutely, as of now, with the data that we have available, especially from the guidelines, it is a viable option. But the sucralfate does contain aluminum, and patients that have renal dysfunction should not take sulfate because of the potential for accumulation of aluminum. So they might be potentially better off with the H2 blocker. Yes, sir. Yeah, so you're right. So it's not the same mechanism of action, but the thought process is that if your gastric pH is higher, if the patients do bleed, then they have a better chance of clotting and recovering from that bleed, where the bleed is not over an extended period of time and causing less damage.
Second question is, absorption doesn't take place, as far as I know, in the stomach. It's in the
That's a very good question. Unfortunately, I did not run across the duodenal pH information. We do know that the gastric pH, generally the goal is to be above 4, for the pH to be above 4. And both H2 blockers and PPIs will get you above 4, but I don't know exactly what the duodenal pH would be. But my guess is if you start off at a higher pH in the stomach, then when it gets alkalized in the duodenum, then there will be more likely to be a higher degree of alkalinization than a higher pH. But I don't have that specific information to tell you whether that's the case or not. Yes, sir.
So, are you referring to the inpatient stress oxygen?
Yes, sir.
To the coagulopathy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so good question. So the question is, in reference to stress ulcer prophylaxis, where we talk about the coagulopathies, is it any, does the patient have to have all three or any of the three? The thought process is any of the three would qualify them as having a coagulopathy. So that's a very good question, and that does come up with not just with Coumadin, but NOACs as well, because they do increase your time to clot, and they potentially can affect your labs as well. And the answer to that question is they only need to be on stress ulcer prophylaxis if they have other risk factors. If they're on an anticoagulant or an antiplatelet, if they have other risk factors for GI bleeds, such as they've had a previous GI bleed within the past year, or any history of a GI bleed, then they might benefit from a stress ulcer prophylaxis. But being on either Coumadin alone or antiplatelet alone would not mean that you automatically need stress ulcer prophylaxis. And with the coagulopathies, the odds ratio is about 5, so you're 5 times more likely to have a bleed if you have a coagulopathy. But the instance is, but the reason for that is you're not able to form a clot after you bleed, versus the mechanical ventilation, who has a much higher risk of 15 times that of a patient who's not on mechanical ventilation. So those are the two definitely, if anything else, those are the two that those patients definitely need stress ulcer prophylaxis. But if they are on anticoagulation, they need to have another risk factor before they would be on stress ulcer prophylaxis. But if their platelets are less than 50 and they're on Coumadin, I probably would recommend doing stress ulcer prophylaxis. Any other questions? No? So thank you again. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.